I'll cast on him my every care and wait for thee, sweet hour of prayer.
I thought about that song, Sweet Hour of Prayer. Prayers mean something, don't they? We've seen benefits, some of them, of prayer this morning. I heard something that I didn't know if I'd ever hear it again when Bo dismissed the service this morning.
Yeah.
A lot of prayers went up there, and that I told him, I said, that made my day.
Yeah.
Glad to be here tonight.
Bless you, Dad.
Glad to be Christian.
Yeah.
I'm glad that I got a love in my heart for each and every one of you, and I'm glad God loves me. I'm not going to take up a lot of time. I know Brother Greg has put in a lot of work, and I appreciate it, what he's done. And I'm going to give him a whole lot of time tonight. Tonight's supposed to be his last night on his teaching. And I don't know if he's behind schedule or on schedule or what, but I'm going to give him all the time I can to just get in there, and I'm going to turn it over to him here just in a little bit. And God knows our hearts, and he knows every prayer that's on our heart tonight. And I'm not going to do open prayer requests. I'm going to do them like I did before with a raised hand. If you've got a special prayer, and God will know all about it. And I want Al, and I want Aaron to stand, and Jimmy stand and open us up in this prayer, and y'all pray right along with them if you would.
Thank you.
One more thing I want to say. Come on, Brother Greg, while he's coming. Tonight, when he gets done, let's all come around and let him know how much we appreciated him, all right? Can we do that? Come on, Brother Greg.
Okay, as Dana said, I'm just going to sort of dig in here a little bit. But throughout the evening here, if anybody has anything to say or has a testimony or anything else that you want to talk about, just speak up and do what the Lord lays on your heart. That'll be no problem on my part. But we are behind a little bit. That's probably mostly my fault, but it is a lot of information to cover. We were hoping to get this done in 4 weeks, but I'm not sure we'll get it all done in 4 weeks. We'll get done what we can in 4 weeks, and then we'll see where we go from there. So, unless somebody has something, I'm just going to sort of start in here and stuff. Just to quickly remind everybody where we were last week, we had gotten to about 300 A.D., somewhere in the 300s, and we talked a lot about the Bible itself and how, you know, the Bible being canonized, and so... So there was, we went over that. I'm not going to repeat that and stuff. But so basically where we're at in time here is we've made it through the first 350 years after Christ was born. And there have been a number of things come up. But the church has somewhat formed as a formal organization, you might say. The church has leaders in different places, and the 27 books of the New Testament that we use today have been put together in a canon and form what we today call the New Testament. So that's sort of where we're at. And the church, as I talked about right at the very end last week, and this is important, I do repeat this just so everybody gets this in their mind, the church, as it's organized, is made up of basically, there's all kinds of different leaders and things, just like we today. We have pastors, we have all you know, local pastors, and then if you're in an organization, you have district leaders and national leaders, depending on your organization. But in that time, there were basically five leaders of the church, and they were located in Rome. They were in Constantinople. Get these right, Alexandria. And in Jerusalem, and in Byzantium. Have I got the five right? I may have one wrong there, but anyway, there were five of them, and they were leaders, and they each had certain areas of the church that they were over, and it was commonly acknowledged at that time and believed at that time that the leader in Rome was considered sort of the leader of the church. It was disputed whether they had total leadership or whether it was just like, it would sort of like be sort of like you've got all these fire chiefs around in an area. They're all fire chiefs. But you might say that you could dispute this, but you might say being the fire chief in the city of Charleston is maybe more prestigious than being the fire chief in the city of Nitro. They're both fire chiefs, but one's a much bigger city. And it was sort of like that. So that was the status of the church at this time in terms of leadership. And so what's happening here is Constantine, and we talked about this last week, Emperor Constantine has become a Christian, or at least he professed to be a Christian. And so now, rather than the church being officially persecuted by the Roman Empire, the church, the Christian church, is now becoming the official religion of the Roman Empire, which controlled all these areas we're talking about, which include the Middle East and Europe and vast parts of Asia. So the church, rather than being under persecution, like we talked about last week, officially, has now become something that's being endorsed by the government of that time, at least the main government of that time. And you might think, wow, that's great. That's great. And in some ways, it is great. There wasn't persecution like had the church had been going through. But in some ways, it's bad, because what you would hope to happen in that case would be that the church would start influencing the government to be much better and be good and be that would, you know, in an ideal world, that's what you would hope would happen. The reality of it is that's not really what happened. It may have happened a little bit, but what really started happening is the church started becoming almost a branch of the government. And depending on who was in the government at any particular place, the church started becoming a weapon of the government. So for instance, you have churches, let's say you have congregations in different cities that are debating some topic. Maybe they're having a big discussion, and one of the biggest discussions at this time was about this concept of the Trinity and how do you talk about it? So you have congregations in different areas talking about this, and you can imagine ourselves if I said tonight, okay, we're going to do a lesson just on the Trinity tonight, and we're going to just let people, and everybody's just going to start talking what they believe about the Trinity. My guess is we'd probably have more than one or two opinions in here, and so. You can imagine this worldwide, somebody having debates about this. So what happens is some of these leaders of the church get to the point where they say, well, wait a minute, John Litton, what you wrote about the Trinity, and I'm just using John as an example, John Litton, what you wrote down about the Trinity, I think's heresy. It's not just that we disagree, it's heresy. And my cousin is the mayor here. He's the state police commandant at the local place down here. And this is the religion of the people. And you know, what we need to punish you. And the next thing you know, you're in the Jackson County jail for heresy. And because I'm going to protect the rest of this congregation, I'm not going to let you, take them. You know, some of these guys would say, I'm not going to let you write that stuff and take them to hell with writing this heresy. I'm going to put you in jail. That's what happened when the church and the government got so intertangled. And that example that I just gave got repeated all over the known world at that time. And it was complicated by other factors. Like last week we talked about the Bible, that 27 canon, that New Testament, was all in Latin. So very few people could read it. Most of you all couldn't have read it. Maybe me and John, he wrote something and I wrote something, and it just became a matter of how well I could convince you all that he was a heretic. That's what it became, almost like a debate club, and also became an issue of who had the most oomph with the local militia to make their thoughts law. And what would happen is so it sort of sounds like a selection we got going on here right now, right? But they would just talk and talk, and eventually convince enough people that John over there is a real heretic, and the next thing you know, he's in jail. And this thing escalated to the point that the governmental leaders, working with the church leaders, started passing laws and saying things like, well, if you disagree to that level and you're declared a heretic, it's not just a matter of me putting you in jail. No, we're just going to kill you. We can't have that. We'll just kill you. It's punishable by death. And there were numerous instances of that, starting in the 300s and on up through, which would be the 4th century on. And so this started happening. In the eastern part of the Christian faith, those other four leaders, besides the one at Rome, the predominant language was Greek. And there was a whole other issue with that, separate from this thing that we're sitting here talking about, in that they couldn't really communicate with each other very good. And there was always this tug of war. Is this Pope, this leader in Rome, is he really the leader, or are we equals? And that went on for a few centuries. So here you have this church that has this scripture. It starts getting so entangled with the government, and the scripture is not in the common people's language, at least in the Western part of the Christian faith. In the Eastern part, parts of it was. It was in Greek, and some of the people could read it. But you had this Western church imposing a lot of influence in the Eastern church. So that's the status of the church in about 350 to 400 B.C. Along with that, two big things started coming up, and I want to read. I want to tell you a little bit about those. There were two big. There's lots of heresies that came up, just like today. You know, you'll hear about somebody starting a new church based on something, some tiny little theology they get out of the whole faith. That back then is no different. But in this case, there are two of these that we need to talk a little bit about real quick here. The first one that you all talked a little bit last week about, and it still goes on today, and there have been movies about it and all this kind of stuff, but it's called Gnosticism. Everybody's heard of Gnosticism, right? The Gnostics, the Gnostic Gospels, the movies and all that stuff. So what is Gnosticism besides Tom Hanks movie? What is Gnosticism besides somebody running around like Mission Impossible and chasing these old manuscripts and stuff? That's not really Gnosticism. That's just drama to make money. Well, it is alternative books of the Bible, was the result of it. And there were some gospels called the Gnostic Gospels. But what is Gnosticism itself is what I'm asking. Okay, let me tell you here. Now, when I read this, you guys are going to go, what? What? Okay, just listen. I'm just going to read this because if I try to explain it, you won't believe me. Okay, so here we go. Okay, Gnosticism existed in a small form all the way back to the time in the New Testament, Paul and John. And heresies that you hear Paul and John writing about in their epistles is Gnosticism. That's what it is, okay? And they both wrote about resisting it. But it became much more to the forefront in the second century. Today, the thing that we have most close to that is something that we call the New Age movement. Anybody ever hear that? All right. So what it is it's really a mixture of Judaism, Christianity, Greek philosophy, and Oriental mysticism, but mostly Greek philosophy and Oriental mysticism. So here's the basic teachings of Gnosticism. Now, it has lots of different forms, okay? But here's the basic teaching. First of all, and you guys will recognize this from some of the first class we had when we talked about some of the other religions of the world that don't come from Christianity. It basically says that anything that's matter, like wood, the building, us, anything that is made of matter is evil, and the only good is in the spirit, is the spirit. Therefore, God being spirit and good, here's what Gnosticism says. Therefore, God being a spirit and therefore good could not have directly created the world because it's bad, which is physical and evil. Instead, what it says is that there has been a series of emanations from God being progressively more evil. And the last one was something called the Demiurge, which was an evil god created by God. And in Gnosticism, this is what you will never believe. You'll never see this in a Tom Hanks movie. The evil god, the worst evil god, is identified with Jehovah of the Old Testament, who created the world. What then happened is the good God, out of pity for man, sent his highest emanation, Christ, as an emissary of light to dispel man's spiritual darkness. Now you see how this comes back around and it starts to sound like, hey, maybe this makes sense. Christ, they believe, was either some form of a non-physical spirit or phantom, and there's a name for that, or else he was a spiritual essence that just occupied Jesus' body from the time of his baptism until his death. Remember when the dove landed on Jesus when he was baptized? True Gnostics, who are believed to be very few, for them, salvation is attained only through knowledge of the good God. And that is enhanced by some mystical rites, and they would include baptism and marriage to Christ as part of that. Ordinary people only obtain salvation through a whole series of faith and mostly good works. It's a works-type salvation. Since the body, in Gnosticism, since the body is physical and totally evil, there's only two things you can do with it. One is you can just punish it unbelievably, which is some of the monastic, asceticism type things that we talked about last week a little bit. Or, and this is where Gnosticism really went to a lot, was don't even worry about it. Just let it have complete, unrestrained evil, because the only thing that'll matter is what happens once you die. And then your soul will be free. Now, forms of this Gnosticism permeated the world at that time. And it even started finding its way into the church. That's what Paul and John and them were writing about. So during this whole time, a lot of these people are dealing with this in the church, a lot of these pastors and stuff. So beginning there, now that you're past this persecution, you've got this Gnosticism just permeating through the church. A second thing that occurred, which is much more subtle, was the whole issue of the Trinity. And there was a priest from Alexandria named Arius, who did a lot of writing, and basically what he concluded was that Jesus was not eternal. In other words, when you think of the Trinity, what he taught was that the Father was eternal, and Jesus being the Son was created at some point. He wasn't eternal. And that also, if the corollary to that would be that the Spirit was also had a beginning. So what happened is, right after the Bible was canonized, or right in that same time frame, there were huge debates about this Arianism, as it was called, and this Gnosticism that was creeping into the church. Yes, Steve?
Are there any ancient writings that would give somebody any idea of all these crazy things you're talking about? Or was it like Muhammad come along, and decided that he's going to have all these scriptural things and write them later on?
Well, in the case of Arius, he was a monk, a Christian monk, who believed that Jesus was created by God to do what he did, to save us. It wasn't that he denied the fact that Jesus was our salvation and all that. He just believed that God, the Father, created Jesus. He was a son, his concept, and he was created. Now, this Gnosticism, you can see forms of it in Hinduism and stuff. It's ancient stuff that people started taking bits and pieces of stuff together. It's really two different things, but it both came into the church. Now, Arius was in the 200s. ADs, and he wrote a series of really books on this, about this idea that Jesus wasn't eternal, and the Spirit wasn't eternal, and because of that, here's what I'm trying to get to here. Because of that, in the 300 at the There was a council of Nicaea in 325 A.D. that wrote a creed. How many of you have heard the Nicene Creed? You probably quoted it in your church, in churches. Okay, that Nicene Creed was a statement of the faith that a lot of the church leaders put together. That Nicene Creed was written before the Bible was canonized. As a matter of fact, when the Bible was canonized, they used the Nicene Creed as part of the test to canonize the books because it was considered to be the closest joint document that was a comprehensive statement of the Christian faith at that time. Later on in that century, when the Bible was canonized, there was another conference in Constantinople, and at that conference, there's a place in the Nicene Creed where it talks about the Holy Spirit. And it says that he, I can't quote it exactly, but it says that he proceeded from the Father. And then what happened in the council at Constantinople, they added the term, and from the Father and the Son. And that term, and the Son, was debated from that in 381 or 391 AD. It was debated from that point until an event that we're going to get to here in a little while, which is in 1054 AD. When the East and West Church were split. And it's called the Filioque Clause. And that's what it means in Latin, and the Son. That word Filioque means and the Son. And the whole debate is over whether the Spirit, in that case, and the Son are eternal. Are they co-equal? Are they truly God? Or are they under the Father, less than the Father? And this carried on for centuries. While all that is going on, this theological debate's going on in the church starts on a journey starting about 400 AD where it becomes completely entangled with the world governments. So you're having these theological debates over the next few centuries. Right in the midst of it, the church itself has become a political, the church organization. Now, I'm not talking about the everyday Christian that lives in cities and towns all over the world, just like today. But the church organization becomes entangled to the point that it becomes just a branch, almost, of the government. So, starting in the 4th century A.D., in that outline that I gave you all last week, I don't know if any of you have it with you, what starts happening is the church becomes accepted. And in 500 A.D., they start having these councils that are trying to clarify these doctrines that we're talking about. The Roman Empire itself is collapsing as we know it, but it's being taken over by something that we probably today would call the Holy Roman Empire, where the church and the government have become one. And the power is being centralized in Rome. Today we call the what we see today, the remnant of that still exists today. When I say remnant, I don't mean to minimize it, is the Pope, the government that's in the Catholic Church. They're not the same as they were back then, but that's the lineage of the Pope comes from that. So in the 5th century AD, the church and the government start becoming one. And so we're up to about 500 AD, and through one of the things that comes out in the 5th century that was written by probably the the most prolific writer, theologian of ever, St. Augustine. This is, now if you think about this, this is in 500 AD, this thought comes out. But he basically says, the heart is restless until it finds its home in God. Now, who argues with that? But this is 500 AD, before this is written and verbalized in a way that people can start to understand it. But St. Augustine wrote that in the 400s, right before 500 AD. The heart is restless until it finds its home in God.
Amen.
Yeah. So now we get into 500 to 600 AD, and the church starts expanding in terms of it's spreading all over the world, but it's not the church that probably we think of today. It is a church that is almost like a government. It's branching out and it's expanding, and its influence is growing and growing and growing. And one of the places that it's really growing is in the Middle East. So somewhere in the late 500s, the church is really starting to make some inroads in the Middle East, especially in the Arabian Peninsula. But what happens in the Arabian Peninsula at this time is, and I talked about this last time, the Arabian Peninsula is made up of a bunch of nomadic tribes and people who have multiple gods that they worship. I mean, just hundreds and thousands of them. And so the church is starting to come into this. And in 570 AD, something happens in the Arabian Peninsula, the beginning of something happens. In 570 AD, a person that we know today as Muhammad is born. And he enters into this world that we're talking about here, where the church has, as seen by the common person, a lot of the common people out there, is this political entity that's out there that's doing things, some good, some not so good. In the Arabian Peninsula, there is a real hunger for, and there's a void there. What do we do here? And starting when he's about 40 years old, Muhammad, at least he says, starts having these experiences where he says he is hearing from God, and he starts dictating and writing what we now today call the Quran. And what happens is he, through his writings, develops what we today call Islam. So starting in about 610 to about 618 AD, he's writing these things in the city of Mecca in Saudi Arabia. And he is espousing a single God in the middle of a group of people who have multiple gods. So there's a lot of hunger and thirst for something here. And the church is there too. Ultimately, what happens is Muhammad gains some political backing in Mecca, and just like what was happening with the church, fights start. Almost war breaks out. And Muhammad and his followers are ran out of Mecca. and they go to another city nearby. And I can't say the name of it. It's like Y-A-H-T-I-B, I think is the way it was spelled at that time. Today, we know it as Medina. And he goes there because he has support there, and he consolidates his power there. And then, after about 3 or 4 years, he comes back to Mecca with soldiers, and he conquers Mecca. And that huge, I don't know how to say it, Jimmy. Is it a Kaaba or it's a huge place of worship there in Mecca. It's K-A-A-B. I'm not sure how you pronounce that. He conquers that. And he, through his writings, and he only lives about 4 or 5 years after he finally conquers that. And he completely dictates today what we call the Quran. But he consolidates his power to the point that this new religion at the time that we today know as Islam has completely formed and has control of that area. After he dies, they believe basically that the true God is called Allah, which was the name given to him supposedly in the Quran. And they believe that Muhammad was his last great prophet. That's what the Quran says. And that's what he taught. So this is consolidated now. Now here's the interesting part of this is for the next couple hundred years, the Arabic people and this new religion, Islam, becomes basically the fastest growing religion in the world at that time, especially in that area. And they do things like they go out and they were one of the first societies that did things like build hospitals for the common people. They even had sort of pre-American welfare type programs. They had educational programs for common people's kids. They were very scientific. Some of the best mathematicians and scientists of those eras came out of this society we're talking about. So for about 200 or 300 years, they're just growing and growing, but they're still attached to the government like the church is. So here we have now, from about 650 AD, we have this new religion called Islam growing like crazy in that part of the world. And the church, as we know it, is over here, and it's still growing to some extent, but it's very, very, it's almost like a government. I don't want to sound that bad, but it has a lot of traits of the government. But it's not as evangelistic as it was at its beginning.
It's, would it be a fair summary to say, in very simplistic terms, that it's highly likely that the reason Islam became so big was because they were doing things that the people thought they were helping, while the church was probably spending their time bickering, and so it appealed to people.
Well, there was definitely, the church was bickering. And they definitely appealed to people's common needs. We have, in my opinion, we won't get to them this week, but we have modern pseudo-Christian organizations that have grown doing exactly the same thing. So they didn't see anything new. By appealing to people's raw needs. But what's happening here is, for the next couple hundred years, this goes on. Well, what then happens is remember, you still got these Eastern Church, these four, I'll call them popes, and then you got the one in Rome. Okay? So somewhere, let me get the right century here, because I want to get to this next step. It's very important. We get to a point somewhere around in the 1000 to really it's the 12th century, 1100 to 1200 AD, where you've got this Muslim or Islam, faith of Islam over here that's grown, and it's rivaling the Church of the East in size, especially in the Arabian Peninsula and all those areas. There's still great parts of that world that is Christian. What then happens is the Islam then starts expanding westward, and Jerusalem, Israel, comes under the control of Islam in terms of who controls the land. And it spreads all the way into the Ottoman Empire, into Turkey, in places like that. So now you've got Islam and this Eastern Church in competition with each other in the same land. While all that's going on, the Eastern Church and the Western Church are still bickering, like you're talking about, Pam. There's still all this bickering going on. All this fighting going on. So, and one of the big things they're fighting about is the Trinity. They're arguing over the Trinity, and they argue constantly, to the point that in 1054 AD, the Pope in Rome sends an emissary to Constantinople to tell the Pope in Constantinople that because he is not quoting this modified Nicene Creed in his churches, that they are not quoting it exactly as the Roman Church says. And I'm not saying the Roman Church is wrong in what they're saying, how it should be quoted, but he says, you're doing it wrong. That emissary comes to Constantinople and for months debates publicly with the Pope, what I'll call him the Pope, he's really a patriarch, at Constantinople. They reach no agreement. Now, the guy he sent was not the most tactful person in the world. So on one Sunday morning, when the leader of the church in Constantinople, which at this time had become the leader of the Eastern Church, is preaching. Now, picture this on Sunday morning. Pastor Al's up here preaching. I'm not saying this would happen to him, but or Aaron this morning, this emissary, who is a cardinal, walks into the church carrying a big scroll. Of course, everybody there knows who he is. This isn't ain't like me walking in. He walks in, he walks all the way down. The church is full of people. Lays papers with the scroll. There's no printing press, so you can't run out and make Xerox copies in the back room. Lays the scroll down on the altar of the church in Constantinople and says, "You, the patriarch in Constantinople, have now been excommunicated. You're out of the church." And walks out and goes home. Now, what then happens is we call that today, and they call that today, the great schism that occurred in the Christian church. That's when it's typically dated. And from that day until this day, there is a Western church, and then there's an Eastern church. We today typically call the Western church, and we'll get to the point where the Western church breaks up again. We call that the Protestant Reformation. But the Eastern church has never had such a thing as the Protestant Reformation. And it's made up of, we call them the Eastern Orthodox Church, Greek Orthodox, Russian Orthodox. There's numbers of them. And the two churches split. Now, that split didn't just occur on that day and everybody just said, "Okay, see you later." And we've got two different churches. There were battles and fights city by city over this. But the Eastern and Western church was split, and it still exists today. How many of you guys have ever been in a Greek Orthodox or a Russian Orthodox church? You ever attended a service in a... How many of you wonder sometimes, are those people really Christians?
Greek Orthodox wedding.
You did? Yeah. Now, that's probably not the best thing, because sometimes weddings can be not so nice places, just like in the Western church too. But the Greek Orthodox, or the Eastern Orthodox Church and the Western Church, were the two major parts of Christianity that split up. And what complicated things over these next few centuries? In the 12th century, there were these events called the Crusades that occurred. Basically, the Western Church tried to raise money and armies and send them and recapture basically the Holy Land, as we call it today. Islam, which was really the reigning power over here in the East, they allowed at that time the Eastern Church to exist. And you've probably seen on news reports as they're trying to take some of these cities today. They just freed one of the oldest Christian cities that exists, that still exists today, in Iraq. It just got freed. I don't know if you guys saw that on the news. But so Christianity back then, even though Islam controlled that part of the world politically, was allowed to continue on up until these Crusades started. And what happened is the Islamic leaders became very afraid that these Eastern Orthodox leaders were making treaties with these Western people to help them in these Crusades. And they started persecuting them. And they started saying, "No, you can't do that." So now, even if these two churches, the East and the West, want to get back together, which there were lots of attempts to get them back together down through time, well-meaning popes and leaders, not all of them are these evil people. Some of them are very spiritual, very, very, very good people. They're trying to get back together, but because of this political overtone, they're never allowed to get back together because they're afraid that if they get back together, now all of a sudden, when the West comes, it will over, these Eastern Christians will become their allies, and they'll destroy the lands that the Islamic people have control of. So this goes on all the way through till about 1400 AD. That's basically what the church as an organization was made up. You had a Western church, an Eastern church, and Islam over here, and you had the tension going on between the East and the West. What happens in about 1400 AD is a series of very important events. 1300 to 1500 and some AD. One of the things that happens in 1440 AD, I think it's about 1440 AD, something happens that probably changes the whole world, or the ability to reach the whole world. Today, if I were to ask this crowd of people in here, how many of you all remember when the only TV, now, well, first of all, how many of you people remember when there was no such thing as TV in most people's houses? Okay, we got a few of those, right? I'm on the other side of that. Most of us probably remember a time when TV existed to some form or another in a lot of homes. How many of you remember when the only way you could get TV in your house was you had an antenna stuck out beside your house, and you got out there and you sort of hung on it, and you hoped you didn't get electrocuted, and you might get one or two stations. A lot of us can relate to that, right? It's a little bit different today, probably, in most of our homes, right? The world has been opened up, and today we have this thing called the internet, which just brings everything, good and bad, right into your face. Well, the equivalent of that in about 1440 AD, and probably even a bigger event than what we're talking about, was an invention called the printing press. And what happened when the printing press was invented, it made it possible for books to be semi-mass produced, at least in the world that they lived in. And what that meant was, is that if I sat down and translated the Bible from Latin, let's say into English, That takes a long time to do. Now, without the printing press, once I've done that, then begins the task of how do I mass produce that and get it in everybody's hands. You're talking centuries to do that kind of stuff. But with the printing press, once it's translated, copies and pieces of the Bible can be sent out to all kinds of people. So in the 1300s and 1400s, that happened. The printing press was invented. And at that same time, there were some people came along who were really looking at what is really in the Bible itself. Up until this point, most people got their, if you want to call it your theology of what you believe, by attending a church and listening to a talking head like me, I'm doing tonight, droning on, and I can talk in Latin and speak in Latin, and half of you all can't even hear it. You only pick up pieces of what I'm saying. And that's all you knew. But now what happens is people are talking about what the Bible says, and numbers of you all have the Bible in your language or pieces of it. And two or three very important people come along at this time. Lots of more than that, but two very famous people come along. One is a guy named John Wycliffe, who is from England. And he starts translating the Bible into English. And he's ordered not to do that. And he falls under the protection of the English emperor through a whole series of circumstances, and he ultimately almost finishes the translation of the Bible into English before he dies. Because a lot of the religious leaders at that time thought it was a bad thing for the Bible, God's word, to be translated into common language and handed out to everybody, because what that means is all you all are going to read that, and you're going to come to your own ideas, and we're going to end up with 150 different ideas in here. And their idea was, you all aren't smart enough to do that. I'm the one taught in Latin. I'm the one who's... But when I say that, I don't want to make it sound... It's not a good thing. But the flip side of that is, you got to remember, most people at that time had never had any public education. They had nothing. So what the person is saying is you're going to misinterpret what the Bible really says, and you're going to get yourself you're going to get over into things like Gnosticism and stuff real easy, is what's going to happen. That was their logic. So they said it's a bad thing to put God's holy word out like that. Now today we find that an extremely foreign concept, and rightfully so. But I'm just saying, at that time, it was a different world than it is today. So that was their logic. And they would actually fight to keep that from happening. The second guy I want to mention is a guy named John Huss. Anybody ever hear of John Huss? Everybody, how many of you all have heard of John Wycliffe? Yeah. Anybody ever hear of John Huss? Well, John Huss was the guy who inspired John Wycliffe. And John Huss was a monk who lived in what today we call Czechoslovakia. And he was the priest the priest in Prague at the large church there. And he started translating the Bible and reading it. And he started realizing and saying things like, people need to be born again. People need to have an experience with God to be saved, not just do what somebody tells them to do. He started saying all kinds of things like that. He even took the bold step of preaching and conducting all of his services in the native language that was spoken in Prague, not in Latin, which was considered a heretic by a lot of the church leadership. And so while this is going on, John Huss goes through two different times in his life. The first time, the church came in and tried to stop him from doing what he was doing. But the political leaders in Czechoslovakia for reasons not because they were these great churchmen of the world, but for political reasons, protected him and said, you can't do that. We're not going to let you take him away. Then there was a political change that occurred. Believe it or not, at this time, there were two popes, and they were fighting each other in the Western Church. Eventually, that gets settled. Now there's one pope, and he's on the side against John Huss for political reasons. And so he sends in, and he says, we're going to excommunicate you. And they take him away from the church at Prague, and the political leaders do not protect John Huss. There's this long trial that occurs. It means you are out of the church. They would tell you your soul's going to hell. You're out of church. In that day and time, there was a huge debate about whether if you were excommunicated, you could ever come back into the church. And there was lots of people believed you couldn't. They had political power behind them. They had armies behind them. And so this goes on for a period of time. And to summarize, ultimately, John Huss is burned at the stake.
And that's the same Bible we've got here, right?
Same Bible. Same Bible. And he's burned at the stake. So now, here you are, late 1400s. You've got an English translated Bible. You've got bits and pieces of different language. You do have a printing press.
Well, Greg, who finished the
Bible? He had an understudy, and I think his name was actually Purdue. John Purdue. He finished it. And it was mass produced. Not our state treasurer.
My grandmother on my mother's side was a devout Catholic. He had about excommunication. And somebody witnessed to my grandmother and he got converted. Well, the priest come to see her and she said, I no longer need you, but I found the true meaning of Christianity. And I've given him a heart of the Lord. And he said, you're of the
Their idea was that the priesthood, there's a fundamental difference, and I'm about to get to the point that is the fundamental difference in that theology and what we call the Protestant theology. And what happens right after John Huss, and this occurs in the late 1500s, there's another person comes along. And that guy's name, we all know him today, is Martin Luther. And Martin Luther reads John Huss' writings intensely. And Martin Luther is a Catholic priest, a very devout Catholic priest. As a matter of fact, Martin Luther once said that if the practice of asceticism, which I've referenced a lot, which is basically self-denial of yourself. In some cases, they would do unimaginable things to their bodies, trying to make themselves purged of the world. I mean, they would take whips and beat themselves. They would do unbelievable things. If there are lots of accounts of priests who practice asceticism who at some point did something, say they did something with their left hand that they considered a sin. They would cut it off. Just unbelievable things like that. And Martin Luther once said that if there was ever a priest or a churchman that asceticism really did any good, that he would be the first person in line in heaven. That's not a direct quote, but basically like that. Because Martin Luther tried all those things. He was an extremely devout Catholic priest. And even when he did what he did, his idea was not to cause a new church to occur. His idea was, we've got all these priests out here who are very corrupt. They're taking money, they're robbing the poor, they're teaching them the wrong things. They need to change. And his idea was, we need to change things. So in 1517, guess what? On October 31st of 1517, guess what this coming year is? You guys can do the math pretty quick here. 500 years. This is the 500th anniversary. The Pope himself just traveled to Switzerland and celebrated the Protestant Reformation. The modern Pope did. Did you guys see that on the news? Well, you need to quit looking at all the political ads and read the news. He just did that. It's just last week he went there and they had a huge celebration of the Protestant Reformation. The Catholic Pope did. And what Martin Luther did was he wrote down, they called it the 95 Theses, 95 statements that he said, we in the church need to have a dialogue about, and we need to change the church. And he hung them on the door of the church on October 31st, 1517. What ensued after that was a whole bunch of stuff occurred. You can imagine. He was ultimately excommunicated. But he wasn't killed. And what occurred after that is, because the Bible was now available to the common people and it could be mass produced, Martin Luther started a tidal wave of change in the church. And that's even what the Pope said publicly just last week, if you listen to anything that he said. He said the same thing. He started a change in the church that even affected the Catholic Church to some degree. Now, not theologically I'm talking about, but morally and the way they were doing things. And he certainly changed the rest of the Western Church, because the Western Church from that point forward changed, and what we today call the Protestant churches, which we are a part of, started then. And since that time, there have been a whole series of other changes that have occurred in the church through revivals and other things. But that change that occurred was a major change. And God, I believe God used Martin Luther to start that change. And if he had been John Huss, just right before that time, he would have been martyred. He would have been killed. But God always knows what he's doing. And he created the circumstances where Martin Luther could then lead other reformers that we know today on common names, John Calvin, John Wesley. We could go on and on and on. Jonathan Edwards. We could name them the people that we're familiar with. I think that's absolutely right. As a matter of fact, most of these early reformers, almost all of them were. They were, see, we have the false impression that the whole church, the whole Catholic Church at that time, was totally and morally corrupt. That's not true. Now, a lot of the upper leaders were in political alliances and all kinds of things were happening, but there were still a lot of very, very devout, what today we would call Catholics, and people who, and this idea that you have to be born again, that the Bible is over the Nicene Creed, and those that kind of ideas, those are not new ideas to people like Martin Luther. But he was the one that was in the right place at the right time to make that become very widespread. Back to closer to what the early church was. Yeah. Yeah. And here's the theological difference that I said I would mention. There's one very, very big difference. In the organized church prior to the Protestant Reformation, there is this idea, and I think I mentioned it the second class we had, that there is a priesthood. I'm talking about what the church through the Middle Ages and stuff believe. They believe there is a priesthood, and the mantle of the priesthood has been passed down, starting with Peter. We have the scripture we all know very well when Christ said, "Upon this rock I'll build my church," and they believe there is a priesthood that was ordained by God that has been passed down through the centuries, and God calls his lost people working through this priesthood. There's actually, to a little bit of a degree, if you look in the Old Testament of how the law was structured, there is a corollary to that in the Old Testament with Aaron in the priesthood and offering sacrifices for the people. So they follow this logic like that. One of the fundamental things that ultimately, now not immediately, but ultimately Martin Luther came, and the reformers came to the conclusion, is that the priesthood that the believer, you, individually, are in the priesthood. And there's a new covenant where God, through his priest like Melchizedek that sits on his right hand today, is calling you into a holy priesthood. The priesthood in the Protestant faith is the believer is the priest. The priest, the lineage is from God, from God through Christ to you individually. That was a new concept at the time of Martin Luther. It may be hard for us to believe today, but that's true. And that's a big theological difference between the churches. Now, that don't have anything to do with how people behave morally, how well they treat people, things like that. But there is a major theological difference. And just like the East and West churches have never come together, even though they've made lots of attempts, the latest attempt was about 2 years ago. There is a huge theological difference in what you believe, I believe you believe, as Protestants, and what the church that we today would typically call the Catholic Church. And it, again, I'm not saying anything about the way they live or anything, just theologically, this idea of a priesthood, that you are a priesthood called out Yes, sir. I'm sorry. No, I may have said that, but I didn't mean to say that. What I'm saying is Christ is a, the scriptures say Christ is a priest after the order of Melchizedek, and he, Christ, sits on the right hand of God. And the priesthood is, the new covenant is that we are priests under Christ. That's what I meant to say. I'm not sure that's what I said, but that's what I meant to say. Yeah, and that is a big difference in the Catholic Church. There is they believe that the priesthood has been passed down through. And if you look at it, and don't forget about all you hear about the way people behave and the way they do things. If you look at it, you can see some of that logic. If you think about how the Old Testament is. But you're also ignoring, I think, some big major parts of the New Testament where that we are now in a new covenant and there is a new relationship, I believe. But I'm just... Absolutely.
Well, there's also the absence of Jesus really talking about...
You would think... that's one of the primary arguments is if Jesus had intended to have this real, I mean, when he set up the priesthood under Aaron, God elaborately laid it out and said, this is how you have to do this. But Christ did nothing like that. He said, come to me. I think it is. I think it is fairly common. But I know a lot of Catholic people that do read the Bible a lot. But they have a fundamental belief that there is this priesthood, this lineage set up. That's why they have this thing about the Pope. And they'll tell you right. They'll tell you. I mean, the ones that are honest with you, which a lot of them are. They'll say, yeah, we've had terrible popes. We've had people that did horrible things that were the pope. But that priesthood that was ordained by God, they believe started with Peter and has been passed down through uninterrupted until today, is God's way of carrying on his message. Just like with Aaron. That Aaronic priesthood.
I see that in the Old Testament. That's not in the New Testament.
I agree with you, but I'm just saying that was a
thing hired an atheist to write his Bible.
Yeah, it's not.
So there's something, you know, they're losing something there separate.
I think this is one of the big teachings that Martin Luther eventually. When he first put those 95 theses up, he wasn't at the point we're talking about right now. But eventually he got to that point where he recognized that there is a priesthood of the individual believer. That's a hugely different concept than had ever been written and espoused to any degree until the Protestant Reformation. That's hard to believe, but that's 1,500 and some years. That doesn't mean that nobody got saved from the time that Christ was crucified till then. That's not what that means at all. But that theological concept was somewhat new. It's seems crazy to us today, right? Because you think, well, how could you think anything else? But it was very common at that point. You'd probably be right there, wouldn't you?
You wouldn't know any better.
You wouldn't know any better. That doesn't mean that you don't have faith in Christ and you're not saved, but you may have had some. Everybody understand that? So here we are. We've traveled 1,200 years or so tonight through some of the most unbelievable times in the history of the world. And who would think a thing like the printing press would be that big of a deal? But you know what? Who really gave the knowledge to Gutenberg to invent the printing press? Do you think it was an accident or... I'm sorry, Jimmy, go ahead.
Did you mention the Anabaptists a couple days or one of the times?
I mentioned it in, somebody said something about somebody, and I said he was, oh, I know what it was. Somebody said something about the Amish people, and I said, well, they're Anabaptists, and we'll get to that. We haven't got there yet. Those Anabaptists and those types of folks, they come in right immediately after the Protestant Reformation. And a lot of the denominations that we know today, the Presbyterians, the Baptists, the Anabaptists, the denominations that we're familiar with started after the Protestant Reformation. But they all, to some degree or another, have this one fundamental belief. They may express it in a lot of different ways, whether they're Episcopalian or charismatic. They all have this fundamental thing of the priesthood of the believers, which is a lot different than what we would typically call the Eastern Orthodox churches and the Catholic Church.
You're talking about the priesthood that each of us has.
Individually.
I think maybe a simpler term would be direct access.
That's what a lot of people, yes.
It's, you know, you don't have to go to
the right. And that's what that means. That's what that's saying. You know, the priest in the Old Testament was the one who had access to God to pray or offer a sacrifice for the communion, I mean for the sins of the people. In the New Testament theology, the Reformation theology, you have the ability to pray directly to God for the forgiveness of your sins. You do not need an intermediary priest to do that.
Was torn.
Right. Right. You do not need that. You are a holy priesthood. That's a fundamental major theological difference. We can get down to whether you sprinkle with water, you gush with water, you swim with water, you swim with the fish, or stand in the rain and stick your head and bob for apples when you're baptized. Those are all, I don't mean to make light of those, are all interesting things to study, but fundamentally.
Baptism itself is like an individual, I think from what I understand is back in the Old Testament, the priests were the ones who were ritually bathed like that.
Right.
And then with John the Baptist, it became a personal thing for people to be baptized.
Yes. And it, again, we go back to the same thing. There's all kinds of things they did under the old church. One of the major things they did, which caused a lot of corruption in the church, was they sold things called indulgences. Does anybody know what an indulgence is? What is it? Yeah, it's what I do wrong every day. Some people viewed it as that. But what an indulgence was the church got to a point, because you have these priests over here, where they would say things like, okay, Greg, you've really messed up here. So the way you can get right with the Lord, got to pray and do some things. But what you can do is, Pastor, we need some new mics up here. And if you buy the mics, sacrificially giving, you buy the mics, and I'm the priest. The Lord's telling me you buy the mics, and you'll be forgiven, because I'm the priest. I'm offering the sacrifice. Now, we look at that today and we think, that's crazy. But it was real back then because of the teaching. And another thing that they did that we will be real familiar with, but we won't recognize it because of this. One of the things they did was they would say, okay, since the people can't read very good or can't read at all, and it's all in Latin, one of the things we want to do is be able to demonstrate the gospel. So what better way to demonstrate the gospel to someone who can't read and can't speak the language that I'm talking, because I'm talking in Latin. But one way I could do that is in our day, we would say, wow, if we had a nice PowerPoint projector sitting right up here. Greg, you hear me? A nice PowerPoint projector sitting up here. And I could show a bunch of slides up here. I could do a bunch of stuff and tell you guys a story, right? Without even any words. Well, in the Dark Ages, in the 1200s and stuff, there weren't a lot of good projectors around. The bulbs didn't work very good. No, I'm just kidding. But there weren't a lot of those around. So how would you tell a story like that? Do what? Well, you could act it out, and that was one way you could do it. Paintings. Paintings would be a great way, wouldn't it? Paint something. So one thing we could do, we could go to somebody, let's call him Michelangelo, and ask him to draw murals for indulgences. Or we could get to a point where, wow, in my study over there, it would be really nice to have. And you go to the local artist and you say, wow, if you could draw me a mosaic of this, of the virgin birth. Now, never mind the fact that when that thing gets in my study, it's, in their day and age, it was worth the equivalent of millions of dollars. That's sort of a side issue. We won't talk about that. But a lot of the art that was art that was commissioned under the name of these indulgences and penances and stuff. And people like Martin Luther and John Huss, they just railed at this. It drove them crazy. And they said, this is ridiculous. This is immoral. And a lot of the things that spurred them to do the things they did was because of this corruption and stuff that they saw that was going on. And then eventually it got to the point where they had these major theological differences. But so there were lots of things going on at the time that added to all this. That makes sense to everybody? So here we are. We're stuck at about 1600 AD. And I'm done for my 4 weeks. So I will have to leave it up to our church leaders to figure out where we go from here. Obviously, we're in revival next week, which is way more important than anything I could possibly say. And besides that, next Sunday, I will be in Boston. So, pardon me? I'm trying out for the Red Sox now. I'm just kidding. Yeah. But, so, we'll have to discuss whether we do any more of these or not. Maybe we're where we need to be and we don't need to go any further. I don't know. That's up to you all. Doesn't matter to me. But at least I got, I think, to this part of the Protestant Reformation, which I think is a really, really important turning point in the history of our church. From this point forward, you guys will be very, very familiar with what happens in the church a lot more than you were the last 1,200 years. But don't lose sight of the fact that while all this stuff was going on with the Protestant Reformation, there was a lot of things happening with the Islamic faith in that there was a lot of conflict, and it has led to the rise of what we today call radical Islam. But you know what? We had our own version of radical Islam on the Christian side of things. The bottom line is, I believe as a Christian, we should be very engaged with our government, especially in this country. We should get out, vote. We should be very involved. But taking the church organization and tying it to the government is a mistake, in my opinion. And it's a mistake that the early church made. It's a mistake that even Islam made, and they've lost control. And it would be a mistake today for us to do that. If you want to get out and get involved, you want to be president, I'm with you. But Gold Town Community Church should not be your cabinet.
Well, Paul said you should stand. You should make a stand.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean that you intertwine the two. Yeah, I'm with you.
Yeah. Okay. Dana, mercifully, I think I'm done, and you guys can...